You're back with Annie on Solidarity Breakfast, and we've got Peter Jobe on the line. G'day, Peter. How are you?
Good morning, Annie. I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. It was great to hear from you. You are an author of a book called A Narrative of Deceit, and that, of course, is about Australia's connection to the East Timorese in the Indonesian invasion of East Timor. Richard Woolcock.
It's actually called A Narrative of Denial.
Of Denial. Sorry.
By Melbourne University Press.
Oh, I'm glad you... sorry, that was probably a Freudian slip, because I was reading your article about the passing of Richard Woolcott at the ripe old age of 95, who was the diplomat in Australia's diplomat in Indonesia during this whole period. And it's all about deceit, isn't it, really? His tenure there?
It is, although it's important to say that he was not Robinson Crusoe. Richard Woolcott represented the position of the Australian government and the Department of Foreign Affairs in effectively endorsing and not only accepting but actually encouraging the Indonesian intervention and the subsequent 24 years of brutal occupation. The research in my book, I believe, demonstrates that had the Australian government taken a different approach, there never would have been an invasion. Australia actually initiated the Indonesian decision to invade by encouraging the hardline faction within it to incorporate East Timor. Compared to another faction in the Indonesian government that didn't want to take that approach.
Yeah, that's right. Part of the outpourings of tributes to Richard Woolcott was to say that, you know, highlighting the excellent diplomatic work. But the information coming out of them during the Indonesian debacle was quite poor, wasn't it?
It was in a number of ways. First of all, I should explain that there were two factions within the Indonesian government. There was a faction called OPSUS that was a hardline anti-communist faction that wished to incorporate Indonesia by force. And there was Adam Malik and the Indonesian Foreign Ministry that were prepared to accept an independent East Timor. The Australian government, it was initiated by Whitlam, made contact with OPSUS at an early stage to convey to them Whitlam's opinion that East Timor should be incorporated into Indonesia. It was only after that OPSUS approached Suharto to suggest a clandestine program of subversion to undermine the decolonization process instigated by the Portuguese. Now, that was not conveyed by the OPSUS. OPSUS provided a whole lot of briefings telling the Australians exactly what they were doing, including a whole range of illegal and lethal activities. They effectively made Australia complicit in their plans by telling them about it beforehand. But one thing they said that wasn't true was that Adam Malik also supported that position. They were also delinquent in their understanding of the situation of East Timor. Woolcott, for example, constantly said to the media and to the Australian government that Fretland was a very small minority, that was the independence movement, was a very small minority of urban Timorese and not supported by the majority of the population, that would be quickly brushed aside. Now, of course, if anyone with any knowledge of East Timor at the time had actually been there, spoken to Fretland, been to the countryside and spoken to the people, knew that this was completely untrue. So far from being brilliant, and I think an article on the ASPI website made that claim, the diplomatic activity under Woolcott, basically the Indonesians, the OPSUS factions, ran rings around him and made Australia complicit in their plans and provided him false information that set their agenda.
It's horrifying to have it all laid out, how Australia involved itself in its own personal interests, massaging the facts. And Australia, as you point out, Australia had a particular context and view of itself, didn't it?
That's right. Australia viewed itself as the as a representation of Western interests in Southeast Asia, and they wanted to push a particular kind of regime into the region. Now, 10 years previously, in 1965-66, they supported the ousting of Sukarno and the decimation of the Indonesian Communist Party, which cost many, many lives. The new Sukarno regime represented pro-Western interests that were favourable to Western investment. There was also, of course, the Timor Sea, but it wasn't only the Timor Sea. I believe that if the Timor Sea resources had not been there, the policy would have been the same, because they would have supported pro-Western, militarist, autocratic regimes that suited their Cold War agenda at the time and suited Western economic investment.
It takes your breath away how many people were prepared to sacrifice for this pathetic investment and power-driven mantra.
That's right. I should say I have a new article about this the Declassified Australia, which is a new publication. It's been around for about a year. It uses archival research and evidence-based research to produce articles, and it's well worth paying attention to. Declassified Australia is very much an evidence-based publication. My article there is an academic. It's written for the general public, but it has a list of sources, and it's very much evidence-based. And you can click on the link if you want to further your own research to find out where I got my information from.
The article is actually called "The Diplomat and the Hit List." I think that's probably something you would like to talk about, because we're talking about real people here.
Amongst the documents, I spent several years in the National Archives going through all the documentation regarding Australian policy during the occupation of East Timor and the period leading up to it. A very significant document that I found a number of years ago was a list of prominent Timorese that was handed to the Australian Embassy, to Alan Taylor, who was counsellor. Woolcott was his boss, and Woolcott later acknowledged that he saw the document. And it is a list of basically slanders against senior Fretland members, and a list, and it makes it clear that they will be dealt with, and the phrase they use is "when the time comes." This was handed to an Australian diplomat about 3 months before the invasion, making it clear to them that effectively they would be involved in a killing spree to take out these people as soon as they got the chance. This was a part of the Indonesian intelligence effort to, once again, to compromise the Australians, to make them complicit, to put them in a situation where they would not later be able to condemn the Indonesians, because the Indonesians would be able to argue that Australia had effectively agreed. Now, the normal course of behaviour when Australia receives a list of senior politicians who are clearly going to be targeted would be to do two things. First of all, to protest, and secondly, to warn the people on the list that they would be killed. None of those things happened. It was simply ignored because it didn't suit the Australian policy agenda. And indeed, the people who were on the list who were able to be caught were subsequently killed. That included, for example, Rosa Mookie Bonaparte. She was secretary of the Popular Organization of Timorese Women. Nicola Lobato, a very prominent Fretland leader, who was killed immediately upon his capture. And his wife also, Isabel Lobato, was also murdered the day after the invasion. Antonio Calvino, a Fretland writer and poet, he was immediately killed upon his capture, as was his wife, who was also on the list. There were a number of people who were on the list who escaped. They weren't killed because they were not in East Timor. Jose Ramos Horta was in New York, escaped to Australia and then to New York at the time. So they weren't able to target him. Mari Alkatiri, who became the first Prime Minister of East Timor, he was in Mozambique, so he survived. And Shinada Guzmán was on the list as well, but he retreated to the mountains and led the decades-long resistance to Indonesian occupation. But I have no doubt, had they been captured after the invasion, they were on the list and they would have been executed too.
Just takes your breath away, doesn't it? Takes your breath away. How orchestrated this all was, and the complicity of our head of state and his minions, for particular reasons. And people should take this very as a historical lesson and a future advice for how you would think about ideas around power. Wolcott is really fascinating because, as a rather slimy diplomat, who lives a very long time, he then goes through a process of creating a web around his actions that would absolve him, in fact. So he had quite rankles into his retirement. Wolcott argued that Australians who campaigned for independence and against human rights abuses in East Timor were racist and anti-Indonesian for supporting a lost cause which raises false hopes, prolongs conflict and costs lives. It's just an outrage.
Well, indeed. Well, I was an activist during the occupation myself. I was very much involved, and that was an accusation that was often levelled against us, not only by Wolcott, but by other politicians. Now, of course, Wolcott wasn't alone. Remember,
no.
Wolcott was not a dissident who pushed Australian policy into a direction it would not have otherwise gone. On the contrary, he was highly respected within the foreign affairs community because he supported their position so effectively. He was a skilled politician who carried out the policies of the government, as a skilled politician is expected to do, and indeed this was the outcome, supporting a genocide of the Timorese people. About a third of the Timorese people died during the occupation. Now, in terms of a narrative, I call my book A Narrative of a Denial, Australia and the Indonesian Violation of East Timor, because the Australian government, including Wolcott, but also including many politicians, journalists and others, propagated a false narrative about what was going on in East Timor during the occupation. They denied that atrocities were happening. They blamed the Timorese themselves for what was happening there. They protected the Suharto regime, and they worked very hard to get the Timor issue removed from the UN agenda. Australia became basically Suharto's main propaganda outlet during that period, and it was quite effective because it was a liberal democracy that was considered that it would to have knowledge of East Timor due to its proximity.
Yeah, and I didn't realise that there was a forced famine. Starvation was set upon the East Timorese by the Indonesians, and this was part of the denial.
Well, that's right. During the first years after the invasion, the Indonesians were not very effective in gaining control of the whole territory. Prevalent was well armed, and it was well supported by the populace. It retreated to the mountains and in the first year effectively established a fairly well-functioning society with sufficient food resources. Indonesia undertook a program of what you called encirclement and annihilation to destroy Fretland, but they decided that to destroy Fretland, they had to destroy food resources and undermine the civilian population and force them to move to camps, and indeed that's what they did. They used aircraft. They used American-supplied Bronco aircraft. We now know, my own research has indicated that they also used Australian-supplied Nomad aircraft during the operation, probably for surveillance. They defoliated crops. They bombed villages. They forced the population to move down from the mountains to concentration camps, effectively, where there wasn't enough food and many people starved. And that way they were able to undermine the society that Fretlin was had effectively created and force the surrender of many Fretlin operatives. Although, of course, Fretlin never completely surrendered. It was there till the end.
I'll leave the people should go to your article because it's a fascinating read and you have curated it beautifully so people can actually glean the key pieces of information. But it should, I'd like to finish with people realising that in retirement in the mid-90s, Richard Woolcott became a consultant to resource giant BHP on seabed matters. BHP had long prospected for oil and gas in the Timor Sea, and in 1999 it commenced exploration of the Buffalo oil field under Timor's seabed. So bread buttered, no remorse.
Indeed, and at a very early stage before the invasion, Woolcott was quick to point out that it would be in Australia's interests. They would be more likely to obtain control of the Timor Sea resources by doing a deal with the Indonesians than by an independent East Timor. That was what he said before the invasion. He then went on to gain a lucrative position, and he wasn't the only one. There were many who did the same. Those Timor Sea resources.
Alexander Downer and Woodside.
That's right, indeed.
Thanks very much for talking to us this morning, Peter Job. Can you tell my listeners the name of the book as well as the article, where it's written?
The name of the book is A Narrative of Denial, Australia and the Indonesian Violation of East Timor. It's available from Melbourne University Press and all good bookshops, of course. The name of the article is in Declassified Australia. It's called The Ambassador and the Hit List.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks very much.